You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hello and welcome to Viewpoints on this week's show. Over 700 students from the Louis Riel School Division take learning out of the classroom and onto the land.
To me, learning with the land, it's recognizing that our land, it's not just a resource, it's a relative. The land, I was always taught growing up, had spirit. It was life itself.
Celebrating Grace Annie Lockhart, the first woman to receive a bachelor's degree in the British Empire 150 years ago at Mount Allison University.
For women in that time, it would have been an extremely controlled environment. Any time that they would have left the building to go on a processed walk, they would have been chaperoned by faculty or other women from the community. Men were not allowed to see them, so their lives were very much controlled.
Gray divorces are on the rise across the country.
I call them young women in their 50s, after 25, 30 years of marriage, just deciding, you know, I just want to be, and I don't know whether free is the right word, I guess it is, my own decision maker and in control of my life going forward.
And a junior dog handler from Port Medway will represent Nova Scotia at the Canadian Kennel Club's National Junior Handling Championship.
If she doesn't want to stick her ears up, like, I would be like, ears, and then she would stick her ears right back up. Okay.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Hello and welcome to the show. My name is Boris Chassin and I'll be with you for the next half hour as we stroll through the country with our journalists working out of Winnipeg, Sackville, Montreal, and Liverpool today. First up, taking the classroom outside. We all remember the day we were able to go to school, breathing fresh air and running around. Fortunately, teachers and educational institutions have over the years recognized the benefits of such learning strategies. So, over 700 students from the Louis Riel School Division stepped out of their classroom with the goal of developing a greater connection with the land. 16-year-old Lacey Bird stood before her peers and explained that she was filled with excitement and pride in herself and in her fellow students as they embraced the Learning with the Land event for one day. That day, planned to become an annual tradition, was inspired by the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, Land-Based Learning, and the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. On location in Winnipeg, Manitoba, here's Ryan Funk.
Over 700 students from the Louis Riel School Division stepped out of the classroom Thursday with the goal of developing a greater connection with the land. 16-year-old Lacey Bird stood before her peers on the CN stage at the Forks. She explained that she was filled with excitement and pride in herself and her fellow students as they embraced learning with the land.
To me, learning with the land, it's recognizing that our land, like I said early on stage, that it's not just a resource, it's a relative. And the land, I was always taught growing up, had spirit. It was life itself. And to be able to, like, go back to our traditional ways and respecting and living co-side with our land, it's pretty nice, yeah.
Bird is also a youth chief with the Southern Chiefs organization. Through her role as youth chief and emceeing Learning with the Land's opening ceremonies, Bird said she takes her responsibilities seriously, wanting to be an example for future generations, like your younger sister, was among the crowd.
It's a group effort, and this is decolonizing our space and our school division.
Bird and other students diverged when the opening ceremonies closed, heading to stations across the grounds of the Forks. These stations covered a diversity of topics and studies. Some explored Indigenous teachings, and others focused on academic sciences. Suzanne Simpson, a teacher librarian at École Provençale and École Vernis schools, got students to be hands-on, organizing various seeds while they learned about their life cycles and the role of foraging.
I think most kids think of it as something you can buy or something that magically turns into a plant, but we really wanted to capture the whole life cycle and empower them to collect seeds themselves. You don't have to be part of capitalism in order to successfully grow things. So we wanted to really highlight that reuse and empower them to collect seeds on their own by showing them the steps needed to take.
Until the mid-afternoon, students participated in these activities, learning and getting their hands into the grass and dirt. This day, planned to become an annual tradition, was inspired by the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, land-based learning, and the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Ray Norris is part of the organizing committee for the Louis Riel School Division Learning with the Land event. He explained the day is part of the division's multi-year strategic plan and to create new avenues of learning.
Well, an event like this is an opportunity to celebrate together and to dream about what is possible for the future. What might we do, say, in the next academic year, even starting in the fall of 25 and into 26 and 27? And out of this, we're hoping to be able to spur action at a local level with the schools with regard to particularly the Sustainable Development Goals and this whole idea of let's take our learning out of the classroom and into the land and onto our school grounds and then clearly into our local parks as well.
In the Journal of Climate Change and Health, a co-authored paper from Lakehead University asked young people about their thoughts on climate change. 76% of respondents said they find the future frightening, with climate change negatively affecting their mental health. From the school division's perspective, the trustee of Ward 1, Ian Walker, said holding an event like this and having sustainability goals is about setting an example for youth and providing them hope.
I've done that in my own life. My wife and I sold our car a number of years ago, and we get around actively and use transit. We have turned our house into a multifamily so that we have more people living on the land that we exist on in the city, so that we don't have to have as many folks sprawling out. And from a school division perspective, I think that, you know, the whole point of teaching kids is we want to make sure that they have a sustainable future. We want to ensure that they can thrive when they grow up and have all of the things that we've enjoyed in our lives.
Connection to Indigenous teachings and practices was fundamental to the event's identity. Through reconciliation and understanding the seven sacred teachings, Lazy Bird said these acts of decolonization are helping build a brighter future. For Bird, that history before settlers came was a way of life that can be learned from in keeping the water and the land healthier.
Whatever happens to the land will affect us too, and lots of people need to realize that, I guess, especially governments, they need to realize that what's going to happen to the waters, to our lands, is going to affect us as people. We're going to get sicker.
She says that she hopes that by the time the next generation comes, many things will have changed for the better. Full of smiles, with students sitting and running in the sun, Learning with the Land successfully explored land-based learning. The event will continue, said an organizer, but it will likely be under a new name. The future name will recognize the contributions and efforts of Kukum Hilda Kentaban. Kukum Hilda shared Indigenous ways of knowing and being within the division before her passing. Many explained that the pleasant weather during the day was thanks to the spirit of Kukum Hilda. I'm Ryan Funk.
You're on the air with Viewpoints.
Well, it's been a while since May 25th, 1875, when Grace Annie Lockhart became the first woman in the British Empire to earn a bachelor's degree. Born in St. John, Lockhart came to Mount Allison as a 16-year-old, attending what was then called the Ladies' College. She first completed her Mistress of Liberal Arts degree, then a year later her Bachelor of Science degree, and with that, she made history. Erica Butler sat down with Mount Allison archivist David Mahoney to hear more about Lockhart's story and about the forces at play at that time that made Mount Allison the place for this historic first. Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick.
Mount Allison graduates had their moment to cross the stage at Convocation Hall and receive their degrees earlier this month. But 150 years ago this weekend, another graduate earned her degree and achieved a historic first. On May 25, 1875, Grace Annie Lockhart became the first woman in the British Empire to earn an undergraduate university degree. CHMA sat down with Mount Allison archivist David Mawinney to hear more about Lockhart's story and started off asking what it was like at Mount Allison at that time, especially for women like Lockhart.
Well, for women in that time, it would have been an extremely controlled environment. Any time that they would have left the building to go on a processed walk, they would have been chaperoned by faculty or other women from the community. Men were not allowed to see them. In front of the Ladies' College, there's this wonderful image of an evergreen elliptical hedge. And there was a gate, and there was a man that stood at that gate, and the women were allowed to go into that confined area. So their lives were very much controlled. But the other thing that I would say related to that is that they were also given, they were given an academic program that was created by a woman named Mary Electa Adams, who came here when the Ladies' College opened in 1854. She had been denied the opportunity to get a degree. She had attended Victoria College when it was in Belleville, Ontario, before it went to U of T. And I think that there was always a bitterness in her, but also this drive and desire to ensure that women were educated at the same level as men and that they would ultimately achieve that. And the thing that is sort of nice to think about is that she lived long enough to know that she had set that process in place and would have been able to read about one of the students that came after her actually receiving that degree.
Before Grace Annie Lockhart could graduate with a Bachelor of Science degree, the powers that be at Mount Allison had to make the decision to grant degrees to women. We asked Mawinney why he thinks Mount Allison took that step when it did.
I think that the biggest thing is, and this is something that we still are trying to grapple, it was small. It was nimble. And I think within the environment, when you have a class size, like the class that she graduated in, there were 8 graduates. So in that time period, I think that there would have been a lot of cross-pollination. And the principal who was responsible for the Ladies' College at the time, a man named James R. Inch, who ultimately became the third president, had the belief that women were as intelligent as men. He had a mixture of his own children, daughters and sons, and he believed that they both should get the same education, regardless of what their gender was. And he pushed for that. And so that change was announced in Lingley Hall, which was the main hall in that time period in 1872. And I have this very romantic idea of Grace Annie Lockhart actually sitting there, because she would have been here at that point in time. She came as a 16-year-old. So maybe he inspired her to be that person that wanted to get that degree after that announcement.
That's Mount Allison archivist David Mawinney speaking about Grace Annie Lockhart, the first woman in the British Empire to receive an undergraduate degree right here at Mount Allison on May 25th, 1875.
Pamela Hassan in Smithers, BC, and you are listening to Viewpoints.
Till death do us part. That's how marriage vows describe matrimonial bonds. But when those bonds get broken, divorce is often the next logical step. As Canada's divorce rate is now at a 50-year low, imagine that. One demographic where divorce is on the rise is with those over 50. Known as gray divorces, these splits come after one partner has chosen to end a long-term relationship in the hopes of living a happier life with the years they have left. Journalist Elizabeth Oakley sat down with Carol Jameson, a family lawyer with practices in both Haliburton County and the city of Cowartor Lakes in Ontario. She says she has noticed gray divorces trending in popularity since the COVID-19 pandemic and advises her clients to take a more collaborative approach when breaking the bonds of marriage. Elizabeth Oakley.
The kids are gone, and the distractions of the workaday world have been replaced by the quiet days of retirement. It's just you, your spouse, and a nagging reality that you're not happy anymore. That scenario is one being played out across the country as a growing number of older married couples are getting divorced. Since 2020, Canada's divorce rate has dropped to its lowest point in 50 years. But a growing demographic, married people over 50, are giving up their long-term bonds for freedom and the possibility of squeezing more life into the years they have left. This trend is known as a gray divorce, and it's on the rise. According to Statistics Canada, the number of Canadian couples over 65 choosing to divorce has grown by roughly 80% in the last two decades, going from 352,000 in 2010 to 630,000 in 2020. Carol Jamieson is a family lawyer with practices in both Minden and Lindsay. She says she's seen an increase in the number of older married clients coming to her to dissolve their marriages, the majority of whom are women.
I do a lot of divorce work and have for 30 plus years. And I agree that the stats now show, and even locally show, much more long-term marriages falling apart. I know they're calling it the gray divorce, but really, you've got young, I call them young women in their 50s, after 25, 30 years of marriage, just deciding, you know, I just want to be, and I don't know whether free is the right word, I guess it is, but my own decision maker, basically, and in control of my life going forward. I see that a big part of it. It then becomes an issue for them, of course, with the property division, all this kind of spousal support, all this kind of stuff becomes a major issue. Because a lot of, by that time, most people those ages are looking at retirement very soon. So it's much more difficult cutting up the pie then. You know, it's happening. It's I wouldn't say, you know, 50% of the divorces I do are long-term, but, you know, a very good chunk, like 30% even, are long-term relationships. And not necessarily gray, like me, but, you know, long-term relationship is how I would prefer to term it. Even, you know, the common law, too.
StatsCan reports divorces are trending towards increasingly older ages across the board. The average age of divorce previously was 36 years old in 1980, increasing to 46 years in 2020. What's interesting to note is that the average age people are getting married has changed as well, and that younger Canadians are choosing common law unions instead of marriage. But Jamieson warns the division of assets, should they divorce, is not a 50-50 split. In 1986, the average age people got married was around 25, with marriages lasting for nearly 13 years on average. In 2020, the average couple got married around 31 and stayed together almost 15 years. As for gray divorces, the vow to stay till death do us part has shifted, and the stigma of getting a divorce is not what it once was. What motivates a gray divorce is often multi-layered.
I would say it's tired. Clearly the relationship has gone south for quite a long time, and yet, especially for women, you're still expected to fulfill those responsibilities in the home, even when you may also be working full-time, or the two of you are running a business together, which is becoming even more common. Kids are gone. She's not enjoying it anymore, and she's not being appreciated either. She may not have realized she was before, but maybe she was before. I don't know. But it turns on that one party does not feel respected or their contribution acknowledged, and they're just done.
Yeah.
Done with that.
When working with her clients on dissolving their marriages, Jamieson encourages mediation or a collaborative approach rather than protracted court proceedings. The advantages include avoiding unanticipated and often staggering legal fees, as well as a far less acrimonious division of assets. There are now teams of legal advocates that can work together on a divorce to ensure an easier settlement for both parties. Jamieson is a member of the Kawartha Collaborative Practice, which aims to take a streamlined, holistic approach to finding a resolution without the cost and heightened emotions of a courtroom.
You know, they really have to, more so than for younger people, they have to be more open to mediation and compromise. Heading off to court is in nobody's best interest, frankly. The cost is astronomical, and it's not a speedy resolution either most of the times. Both parties have to be committed to that. What has been a popular process of alternate resolution, they call it, is a collaborative law. Now that's become quite popular. We have a group that started up. We've started up, and we've been going for about 10 years, I guess. A lot of us, you have to have specialized training. We go through all this periodically. And it includes family professionals to help with parenting plans. And it includes financial professionals to sort out and collect all the financial data. Now there, you know, it might sound crazy, you've got lawyer for each one plus these neutrals, but it saves time and money. I mean, I'm there to discuss what my client's rights are, the other lawyer as well, and that's why it's important, both sides here, okay. Boy, she's entitled to that. And she's hearing, oh, I may not get that. So they need, you know, everybody's got to compromise. There's never a win-lose. And if you can get to win-win as opposed to a lose-lose, which is court, really, you know, people complain about my bill when we go to court, but if you didn't fight, you wouldn't be paying me. You know, and how much money are you spending to get an extra $500 a month in spousal? Because at the end of the day, you're paid out more than that in legal costs. And I will always approach people like that. You know, you have to think about what it's going to cost you to get. What is it you want, and what's it going to cost? Does that make financial sense?
Yeah.
Or is this a better option? You know, compromise.
Thanks to Elizabeth Oakley. Last story will take us to Nova Scotia today. Haley Fleming, a 12-year-old dog handler from Port Medway, will be flying to Winnipeg in August to compete in the Canadian Kennel Club's National Junior Handling Championship. Haley has been competing in confirmation and obedience shows for about 2 years. She will be up against 13 other junior dog handlers from across the country as old as 19 years old. She's already accomplished a lot in a short time, racking up ribbons and taking home trophies at Kennel Club and 4-H events in Nova Scotia. Haley got her first taste of the dog show ring at 4 years old only when she showed her cousins Corgi. Rick Conrad in Liverpool, Nova Scotia.
If she doesn't want to stick her ears up like, okay, she stopped doing it, but like when she was listening to him, I would be like, ears, and then she would stick her ears right back up, or I'd throw a treat up.
Nella. Haley Fleming Nella. And her 4-year-old collie and Nella practice for the show ring while her other collie Maverick barks encouragement. The 12-year-old dog handler from Port Medway will be flying to Winnipeg in August to represent Nova Scotia in the Canadian Kennel Club's National Junior Handling Championship. Haley has been competing in confirmation and obedience shows for about 2 years. She'll be up against 13 other junior dog handlers from across the country as old as 19. She's already accomplished a lot in a short time, racking up ribbons and taking home trophies at Kennel Club and 4-H events in Nova Scotia. Haley and her family have a dog breeding and kennel business in Port Medway called Medway Kennels. She got her first taste for the dog show ring at 4 years old when she showed her cousins Corgi.
It's fun. It's a hard sport, but once you get the use of it, then it's easy. And with a collie, it's an easy breed. Me and Nala together, we've won a lot of ribbons. And with the male Maverick, we've won a couple of ribbons too.
Haley, who wants to be a professional dog handler someday, says she's comfortable and content in the ring with Nala.
I don't get nervous at all. It's just go in and, like, there's a bunch of people watching you, but it seems scary, but it's not. She doesn't, like, get nervous either. She doesn't pay attention to what other dogs are doing unless they touch her. But other than that, she's pretty good listening.
Haley's mom, Crystal Fleming, says she's proud of what her daughter has accomplished so far.
Pretty honored. I've been with dogs all my life, but I didn't have the confidence like Haley does in the show ring. It wasn't something that I enjoyed. I just did it because it had to be done if you breed dogs. Haley's been totally opposite of that. She loves it, has lots of confidence in the ring, never gets nervous. And it's showing.
Usually at an event like the famous Westminster Kennel Club show, it's the animals that are being judged. But at the National Junior Handling Championship in East St. Paul near Winnipeg, it will be the humans.
In juniors, it's judging the kid on how well the kid does. And of course, if the dog works better with the kid, then they have more of an advantage. But there's lots to learn in juniors. They have to do many different patterns. And they have to know the parts of the dogs. They have to know what the breeds were bred to do. They're going to ask them all kinds of questions. Sometimes at a regular show around here, it would just be one judge, and that judge would get them to show their dog, and she may ask a few questions. At this show, there's going to be five judges. There's going to be one in the main ring with them, getting them to do the patterns and show their dog, and there's going to be four others sitting down, and they're probably going to ask them questions as they go around.
Crystal says they weren't banking on Haley going to the Nationals this year, so they've been asking for donations from friends, family, and the community to help cover the cost.
We went to regionals that day, and that wasn't even in our mind, so we weren't playing for this at all. People have been extremely supportive, like a lot of clients from my kennel and dog show clubs, like they're giving money to help Haley get to Winnipeg.
The event will also feature regular dog shows and obedience trials, and there will be social outings for the junior handlers and their families. Haley says practice and one other vital element have been key to her and Nala's success so far.
Treats. A lot of training, but she loves to train, like she loves doing new things.
She says she's learned a lot working with dogs in the past few years.
Like make him pay attention to me more, and how to eliminate treats in like obedience, because you're not allowed treats in that. But I've learned how to, for your showing, you have to run like a certain way. And, like, I've learned how to run with a glass of water in my hand and without spilling it.
Haley is looking forward to getting into the ring with Nala for the first time at a national competition.
The main reason that I'm actually excited to go is to get the experience. I don't care about winning, just the experience of getting to go there and seeing other junior handlers show, because they're really good.
The National Junior Dog Handling Championship will be held on August 16th in East St. Paul, Manitoba. The winner of that event will represent Canada at the International Junior Handling Championship at Crufts Kennel Club in Birmingham, England, next March.
Okay, go get it.
I'm Rick Conrad.
And that's all for us at Viewpoints. Thanks to our LGI journalists, Erica Butler, Rick Conrad, Ryan Funk, and Elizabeth Oakley. Our national editors are Victoria Fenner and Conrad Fox. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassagne. Thanks for having us this week, and until the next, ciao.
Questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca.